time. Here we go.
Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana, Promise City, Iowa, and the wilds of Yellowstone National Park. This is Larry Batson, and welcome to my wild world tonight. Hope everyone's getting ready for the Christmas holiday. Someone asked me the other day, they said, shopping. They said, I hate to go shopping. And I told them, here's what, when you go shopping, it's like if you're in Africa and you're walking into a troop of baboons. Look at the ground, make no eye contact, and you'll do just fine. That'll work in most of your major department stores. We have a great show tonight. In fact, I've been excited about this for the last 2 weeks. So this is going to be big, everybody, real big. For 30 years, my guest tonight was a backcountry park ranger in America's most popular and largest national park, Yellowstone. His job was to patrol the most remote wilderness area in the lower 48, known as the Thoroughfare District, spending 5 months a year. Imagine that, 5 months a year in a two-room cabin. He patrolled this massive wilderness on horseback, protecting Yellowstone's wildlife against poachers. This gentleman, I'll tell you right now, tonight we're talking to him from his ranch, the Tall Grass Bison Ranch in Promise City, Iowa. Folks, I have a new hero. I would like to welcome to the program Mr. Yellowstone, Bob Jackson. Let's Hello, Bob.
Hi, Larry.
How you doing?
You're very flattering, and my head has already swelled up about three times. So if I die before the end of it from head swelling, I guess it'll happen. So anyway, we'll try to do it here. So go ahead.
Well, you deserve it, sir. I'll tell you what. I've done a lot of research this last few weeks, and you know, you did the job. I can still remember as a youngster. I was lucky. Our family went to Rocky Mountain National Park every summer for 2 weeks. Loved the place. And when we go through that gate and there'd be the park ranger, I told myself when I was a young man, I said, that is the job that I want. I want to be a park ranger. Is that what you wanted to do when you were a youngster? Was that even in your thinking?
My brothers and I always had an interest in the outdoors, and I guess we'd hunt, trap, and fish, just like you'd think about youngsters in a rural Iowa setting. You know, we'd get fur fishing game and outdoor life and all those. So all three of us went to Iowa State University as fish and wildlife biology majors, and I went to Yellowstone because I took a government test right after college and got a good enough score, and you know, one of the two places I could work was Yellowstone National Park. And
wow.
In Iowa, we'd always gone to Minnesota and Canada fishing. I'd never been across the Missouri. So I looked on the map of where you said you would go to, Rocky
right.
Mountain, because I figured, well, you know, John Denver, Rocky Mountain High. So found out that Yellowstone was not in Colorado. It was, had to look up a little further on the map. So, yeah, that's how I started. Yeah. Never seen a mountain before in my life.
So what were your thoughts when you saw these mountains of Wyoming?
I traveled across country in two-lane road, Highway 20, and I knew I could get there to Cody, Wyoming, the first night. But I thought, I want to see the mountains. And I could see them off about 50 miles away. And I got out there and Casper, and of course you see the mountains to the south, and but they're not that tall. And I started work July 11th in 1969, and got to Shoshone, which is south of Cody, and They had the Ab Sirocas up there, and of course I'm looking in to be the east side of those mountains, which is pretty much where I ended up patrolling, right near there for all those years. And there was snow up there on top, and I thought, you know, that's got to be snow. But at the same time, I'm going through all these alkali deposits down there near Casper and out in this arid area. So I pulled into the standard gas station, and I asked the guy there, I says, you know that white stuff up on top? Is that snow or is that alkali deposits? So that's how I started, and the guy was really nice. He could have told the old guys right next to him, they could have said, hey, Joe, why don't you ask him what these are? You know, so whenever I had a what people think of as a dumb tourist question, I could always, have humility and think back on my start. So, yeah, that's how it all started.
Did you really think the guy in the gas station would know what alkali deposits are?
He probably didn't know what that. He probably knew that white stuff on the ground.
He's speaking a different language.
Yeah, he probably didn't think of that. I never had thought that before, or even considered that before you asked that right there. But, he knew what snow was, and that's what it was up there. Yeah, it's hot that day. It's probably 95 degrees. I thought, it can't be snow this late in the summer.
You're right, because you'll be out in that part of the country, and it, like you say, it's 95 degrees in the lowlands, and you look up the mountains, not realizing there's about a 60-degree temperature difference. Or more, so it's kind of. And I've always said the first time you look at those mountains, or when you're in the mountains of the West, it's like a religious experience.
Yeah, the pine smell is what I always remember. The first smell of pine trees, you know, coming up over from Cody, going towards the east entrance, and getting up in the Sylvan Pass area, and pine smell, fresh pine. Yeah, that's what's different.
I want to go west. Oh, man. Now, you're in Iowa right now.
Right.
You're on your bison ranch.
Right.
And you know, you're known as Action Jackson, the park ranger, but a lot of people aren't aware that you are right there in the middle of raising bison in Iowa, and you do it a little bit differently than most of the bison ranchers across the country.
That's correct. We raise them like elephants. They're the same family social order. All herd animals do. People don't think of it that way. And even more so, they don't understand the ramifications. What that really means when you have an animal raised as individuals as compared to in their natural herds that evolution had. And it, just the difference in night and day. So just the way I saw them when I patrolled the backcountry of Yellowstone, because you had a lot of time. You know, you're going 3 mile an hour on your horse and mule, and you're doing a lot of stakeout, a lot of glassing. You know, sometimes you go 3 weeks without seeing anybody. So with my interest in wildlife, of course, that's what I studied, and that's why we started raising them that way back in 1976.
Explain to everyone. Now, I've got some photographs of you. It basically looks like the West 200 years ago with the natural grasslands and so forth. I don't. All I see is prairie grass. I don't see any Kentucky bluegrass or anything like that. All very natural. Explain how important this type of environment, this diet is to these bison.
I think you're referring to our farm here in Iowa.
Right, absolutely.
We got like 500 buffalo on 1,000 acres, and probably a good third of it has never been plowed in the oak savanna and prairie, and we're very fortunate. We're in an area people think of Iowa as all flat and lots of tractors, and, of course, that's where I grew up in northern Iowa. This is southern Iowa, and it's an area that was very seriously considered for inclusion in the Park Service in the 30s because it was so natural still. And if you're raising animals, I'm on an advisory range science BEHAVE initiative for Utah State University and their range science. And they're always thinking how to make cattle, you know, where they can train them to eat different things because you know, grazers are like herbivores. And if you take like an omnivore. We're humans, we're omnivores. We can eat vegetation and we can eat animals, just like a grizzly bear. And as an omnivore, like in Yellowstone, those grizzly bears, they need to be with their mother for the first 2 years. Otherwise, they don't learn enough to eat what vegetation, what roots are out there. Any of them can eat, you know, animal matter without any training. As a, you know, they can be a carnivore, but to be, the vegetation takes training. In the same way as if you have, whether it was cattle or bison, any of those that are herbivores, without training, they're a grassivore. And so they need to have it, of course, from ancestral learning. So most of the, what you have when you have native prairie with hundreds of different species, lots of different broadleaves, and you got all the seed heads and the leaves and the flowers coming on at different times of year. But if animals are weaned off, they just are basically grassivores. They don't know what to eat. So it's ancestral learning that's passed down through, and that's a huge, huge difference in how they taste, fresh, clean taste, a lot more nutritional value in the meat. It's pretty much what the Native Americans had before white man. But we just never realized what the difference was. But, yeah, so we're very fortunate. We love it. I never get tired of going out there and looking in the herd and seeing how the different families interact. Like today, we had to move the buffalo across to another pasture across the road, and there was one cow that was clear off back there by herself, and the last two bulls came, and they wouldn't go further. And so all at once the cow came, and as soon as the cow came across the road from a quarter mile away, then they all hit it out. So they're protecting each other. It's really neat to see.
Well, and you raise the bison, of course, for food, and there's no comparison, for instance, to the meat that's sold in a grocery store compared to what, because I saw in the information that they've literally had no types of drugs or anything, not even for insect control. It's all done naturally.
Yeah, and it really does, you know, everybody talks about grass-fed nowadays, and of course that's in reaction to what you'll see animals in feedlots, you know, whether pigs are in confinement or whether cattle in feedlots. It's because of all the antibiotics and all the growth hormones they put in, so people are saying, hey, we want grass-fed, because basically we're trying to get away something that's not natural. But they don't really realize, even the producers out there, that grass-fed is basically just grass-fed, and there's so much more that those animals, your broadleaves have all the minerals, all your different proteins. Like our buffalo in the fall, we have like a 300-acre pasture and a lot of draws, five different creeks going through it, and there's a lot of locusts down low. And when they drop those pods in the fall, you won't even see a buffalo out there eating grass. They're eating all those pods because it's a legume and it's a real nutrient protein rich. And but if they have never had the training from their ancestors, they don't know that that's edible. So it'd be like us eating cornflakes every day. You know, we might grow up, but we're not going to be as healthy, and that's what animals that have to eat grass all the time and not eat the broadleaves. So if you have prairie, you can take advantage of that if you have that ancestral learning, you keep those families together and you don't wean those calves off. That's correct, right?
Well, that's I when I was talking to you the other night after that big blast of winter that you guys got, we saw a little bit of it, not much, but I said there's nothing probably more beautiful than those big bull buffaloes making their way through those snowdrifts and across that pasture land you have there.
Yeah. Most bison producers that can't keep buffalo bulls past 5 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
And we keep them until they're 20, 25, a lot of the bulls. They're the ones that are the protectors. They're the ones that keep discipline within the herd. They're so important, they are, to have that. And they can mellow the herd out, you know. They're not panicky and they're not scared. So we love those big guys, and you'll if you ever seen any of like Catlin's paintings from the early 1800s when he went out west and
right.
Did a lot of paintings of the Indian tribes, the Mandans and those, and then of the buffalo, and you'll see them, the herds you know, like bull groups following each other. That's what ours is like. I mean, they'll just get in a string and maybe 20, 30 bulls, and the oldest ones will be first, and they just keep on coming down until they get to the, like, the three-year-olds once they leave their mothers. And the younger ones just think of these older guys as just their heroes. Yeah, it's pretty neat to see it like that. Yeah, yeah, it is.
Absolutely.
We don't just have bulls for breeding. We have all the different ages. Yeah, what we butcher are family groups. Yeah.
Do you remember the first time that you were on the job in Yellowstone National Park?
What do you mean as far as, like, the first day coming
in? Yeah,
the
first day you were a ranger in Yellowstone.
Yeah, the first 3 years I worked for the Bureau of Sport Fisheries, right there in the center of Yellowstone, right near Yellowstone Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I switched over to the Park Service, but there was a lot of fish surveys, and this other guy is from Tennessee, and myself, where I suppose were supposedly the best fishermen, so it was pretty nice. They'd have, you know, pesticide studies above and below development, so the boss would get the map out, and he'd say, I want you to hike to here, stay overnight, and catch 10 pounds of trout, and then he say, then I want you to go below the area, like, let's say, Mammoth, you know, the on the Gardner River and catch 10 pounds. And we thought, man, that's right next to the road going between Mammoth and Gardner. You know, the whole river is right next there. How can we catch 10 pounds of fish? So, but you catch 10 pounds of fish, put them on formaldehyde, and then you'd fish the rest of the afternoon. So, yeah, that was my introduction to Yellowstone. Plus, we had a lot of boating on the lake where we'd survey fishermen. So I got to go all over the park those first 3 years, and, of course, then that's when I decided I'd like to be in that most remote spot in the lower 48, down in the very southeast corner of Yellowstone, you know, as a backcountry ranger. And in the end, it meant to stay as a backcountry ranger that you couldn't go permanent. If you go permanent, they put you in an office. So I don't have any retirement. At the same time, once you get 57, you can't legally shoot bad guys anymore. So I'm retired from Yellowstone as of 2003, and since we've been raised in Buffalo since 76, then that's what we do now all the time.
You miss the old Yellowstone?
The adventure, yeah, the adventure is really there. The mountains to me are very beautiful. It's fairly sterile. You know, you just don't, even though you think of Yellowstone and all the wildlife, it doesn't have the lushness and the fertility like you have here in, you know, some of the natural areas of the Midwest. And, of course, the Midwest, we don't have the huge Serengeti-type herds like you have in Africa. All you can do is read the history, you know, the early accounts and see what was here. Maybe because I grew up in Iowa, but, you know, it's warmer, it's more peaceful. But the mountains have the adventure. You never know what you're going to see there. And you do get an inkling of what was there before. You know, all the, you know, a lot of, there's some of the areas in Yellowstone that I patrolled there that has never had a white man in. Some of those smaller drainages you would go up in, and you'd go see the Indian camps, and you'd see chipping piles maybe 2-3 feet high. And any white men, you know, they would have disturbed that stuff and sorted through it to find, you know, partial arrowheads or something. But some areas, yeah, I was the only one to ever see that ever as a white man, I guarantee it. Yeah. So that's adventure, yeah. So I miss the adventure, yes, I do that.
Well, you also were a proponent of the grizzly bear. In fact, you once said those bears are a unique living link with our untamed pioneer heritage, and they deserve a place out here. Think of a grizzly bear as a success in Yellowstone now?
To me, what was neat about the grizzly bear is that it humbles you. You know, there wasn't a single night that I had six cabins that I patrol that were from 12 to 18 miles apart, and I'd make big circuits, you know, maybe 100 miles. And the closest I'd get to a road was 19 and a half miles away for those months. And, you know, you can think while you're on a horse that you're pretty macho, but the bears, if they, you know, that there's something out there that's higher up, you know, that can take you out, then it puts you, as far as a perspective of who you are and how you fit in, entirely different. And, you know, you had to think about it every time you go out of a cabin door after dark. You know, you didn't have electricity. You had Coleman lanterns. There was no porch light to flick on. And a lot of times the bears would come around the cabins because you're near the boundary, and they'd be looking for the gut piles. And so if you open a door and you shine the light out and there's a bear on that porch, he had a 50-50 chance coming at you. So anytime you went out after dark, yeah, you had a flashlight, you had your gun, and you had your bear spray, and you'd make noise going to the outhouse. Yes, that's so it was very humbling, and not so much humble that you're, you know, feel inferior, but you definitely feel a part of it. Yeah, that's for sure. And that's what a bear does for you, a grizzly bear. And, yeah, they need to be protected because it does let us know who we are.
They really, pretty much, when they look at you, they don't think, they're not too impressed, are they, Bob?
Yeah, grizzly bear, I've had four times where I could feel my scalp move because of bears during all those years. And, you know, if you're staking out, you hear shots up in the park, and, of course, you may be well off of any regular trail, you know, people trail, and you leave your horse a quarter mile away because even though my horse would never whinny, if another horse smells them, then they might whinny and tip you off or tip off the poachers. So you figure the game trail they're coming out on, you leave your horse and you wait, and it's quiet and it's after dark, and depending on which way the wind is, all at once you hear a woof, you know, right behind you, maybe 5 feet, maybe 10 feet, and there's nothing you can do, no matter what kind of gun you have. So your scalp moves. I'm sure that's what they talk about where your hair stands on end. So at a 50-50 chance at each time, you know, I never did get had. I've been charged, but I've never had, you know, I've taken partial bodies out of the backcountry, you know, where people got eaten. But I was very fortunate, yes. Of course, I thought of them all the time. I always was cognizant of where they were, or tried to think of where they were, but you never know for sure.
All I can even remember as a youngster, and heck, we stayed at the campground by the fishing bridge. And even in the daytime, walking through the park, you constantly thought about bears. And then where you were at, you were more likely to run into them. What were you more? I don't know how to say this. Worried about the poachers or the bears?
I don't know. It's like the Wild West. I mean, it's kind of like they see movies. It actually is. Where I was, it was just outfitters, larger outfitter camps, you know, where you had a outfitter, a camp boss, maybe 6-7 guides in a camp, camp cook, a helper. You know, they're coming in 30-some miles, you know, with their hunters. And so it's too far in for most private hunters to come in. So I didn't have to worry as much about the unpredictable. The problem I had with poachers, and some of these were fairly professional. A lot of areas you didn't have radio connection out, and some rangers, I hate to say it, were afraid to ever get off the trail just because they knew they could be in deep, deep doo-doo. You know, but if you just push yourself, you keep doing it and doing it, you either got to keep forging ahead and doing more than you ever done before, or else you got to get out of the backcountry. Because after a while, it isn't so much it's the intimidation of the people that are back there, because there's more of them than you. But usually the rangers that would have to get out was because of the bears. The bears is what disturbed them the most. And for me, it was, you know, it could happen any time. You know, you'd always tell bear stories in the cabins. You show the people the big tooth marks on the top of the door frame, you know, right there as you come out of the door, you know, big rips in the sides of the logs, you know, things like this, and where windows have been smashed in, things like this, you know, and it's pretty sensational. But I don't know. It's a toss-up. You know, no matter how many years I was staking out all at once, if you had a place that was 7-8 years where you're staking because it's in between cabins and you got a tent up and it's off the boundary, you don't want them to ever know you're there and you're traveling at night away from your horses, and all at once you stake out where you know they're coming through and you hear the hooves of the horses coming towards you, and it's your heart pounds. It's just because, you know, and the gun gets heavy. You always handle it, but boy, there's some heavy breathing there. So with the humans, it was more planned. You know, it was more with the bears, it's happening right away. You know, it's too fast, and you just react with a bear. With a human, it has to do with staking out, waiting, trying to solve it, you know. So the apprehension of the wait is worse with the poacher. Yeah. I don't know if I answered it right as far as which one's worse,
perfectly.
But they're both unique. They are.
Well, I received, when folks found out that you were going to be on, I received one email that basically said to me that Bob Jackson is a legend in Yellowstone National Park. Every park ranger that's ever been a park ranger would give anything to be a Bob Jackson. And you were probably responsible for more arrest as far as poachers and all the rangers combined.
Yeah, they did some stories on me when I used to write government reports on what was happening to the bears when the outfitters outside the park started putting out illegal salts and to draw the elk out of Yellowstone. But then, of course, they were shooting a lot more. Instead of maybe 15 or 20 per camp, you know, they were shooting maybe 80 per camp, and the camps were like 5 miles apart, and so I might have 300 carcasses in a 2-by-20-mile length area on the boundary, and they just didn't want to take all the meat out, and, you know, they just, it was too much for them to take it all out when they had that. So all at once you had lots of carcasses there. It was something that was the same as a bears and salmon runs. They know when it is, and so they get habituated. So you have lots of bears there, and you have lots of problems. And I don't know. I mean, you got to keep saying, hey, this is what's wrong, and that was a national issue. And so then when they started writing about that, and then, of course, they did some research, and they said, yeah, Bob Jackson's caught more poachers than all the rangers combined for the last 40 years. So, and I guess it was even before that. But that was my specialty. I did lots of tracking. You do, it isn't where you use tracking, you know, footprints in front of you. You got to understand your prey, figure out where they're going to go. You got to know where the wildlife is. And then they could go about 3 mile an hour, and I could go 2 mile an hour. The only thing is they'd stop the glass and things like this. So, yeah, that's what I did. You know, it was pretty much fall time was poacher patrol. Summertime was finding places to make stakeout camps, you know, way away from any cabin where you'd have stashes. And, you know, you're also checking, you know, summer outfitter camps and backpackers, and you're doing trail work. But the focus was always, you know, figuring out how to make it work in the fall, you know, as far as the boundary patrol.
Native Americans couldn't comprehend that type of voice, could they?
No, they. It really is a lot different. You know, there's too many Walter Mitty attitudes out there. You know, the hunter themselves, you know, they think they may understand it, but when they go that far back, they're pretty much under the wing of the outfitter. And so they lose what, you know, maybe they're a lot more ethical when they're in their own element. But when you're totally dependent on somebody to get you out of there or to even take you around so you don't get lost, then you'll do things that you don't normally do. The only thing is when you finally separate the hunters from the guides, that's what the guides would fear, because, you know, the hunter – would panic, you know, and so he'd give away the story pretty fast. I don't know. It was all a matter of strength and determination when you're with poachers. And there are all the guides, and maybe they've never been caught before, or their camp boss hasn't, or maybe the hunter's, you know, been all over the world. And it comes down, everyone's got a story, but in the end, you know, if you got more strength and determination than they do when you're out there, and, you know, they would all cry, except for one pathological outfitter that really didn't know how to tell the truth, but the tears had come down, and the gig was up. Yeah, so it's fairly emotional setting when you're in that. And, of course, anything can happen when it's emotional like that. So you're always got to be aware of where the guns are. And so, yeah, I don't know if I got off on what your question was or got off the side, but
not at all.
I guess I was thinking about
it. Not at all. Well, all I can say is I'm glad there was a Bob Jackson looking over our part of Yellowstone National Park. We're going to take a break. We've got some announcements. Bob, if you need to go get a cold beverage, here's your opportunity. We'll
okay.
be back in
and
about
you'll be
three.
Giving a call back?
No, you stay right there. Keep your phone on.
Okay.
And we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in about 3 or 4 minutes. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Larry Batson. You're talking to Mr. Bob Jackson. This is My Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, talk with you very soon here.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Pat Green. The blood supply is at critically low levels, and you can help. Call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. That's 1-800-GIVE-LIFE to schedule your appointment to donate blood. Your donation is critical because every 2 seconds someone in America needs blood. That's accident victims, surgical candidates, and cancer patients, just to name a few. Please donate blood and encourage your friends, family, and neighbors to give too. Please call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to make your appointment. Thank you.
Take me fishing and show me how to drive the boat.
Take me fishing so I can tell you what a great dad you've been.
Take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you.
Take me fishing because I miss my boy.
Rediscover the joy of boating and fishing. Get information and get going at takemefishing.org.
Hi, this is Paul McCartney on behalf of RAD. If you're drinking, you can't drive my car or any car. Remember, if you're partying this holiday season, don't drink and drive. Got it? It's just not worth it. Doesn't make sense. Thank you.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Duty, freedom, country, family. They're the values that make America strong and what our armed forces are fighting to defend.
While many talk about these ideals without action, they are just empty words.
If you think America's military families deserve more, log on to thanksusa.org. It's a great way to thank our troops and give military families the gift of education.
Thanksusa.org. Scholarships for America's military families. You can make a difference.
We're Rascal Flats. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a
Bear sighting?
Location.
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
There are some visitors you'd just rather not see. Like your obnoxious brother-in-law, Louie.
Hey, everybody, we're here. Good to see you. When do we eat?
But then there are some visitors you just can't get enough of. To make your farm or ranch a more attractive place for the visitors you actually want to see, contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office. They can help you build the habitat wildlife loves. But as for Louie, try disconnecting the doorbell. This message brought to you by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and this radio station.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone. It's Larry Batson. This is my Wild World, and tonight we have an absolutely amazing guest, legend. From Yellowstone National Park, I should really say from Promise City, Iowa, on his bison ranch, Mr. Bob Jackson. Bob, are you doing okay?
Yep, I'm right here. Yeah, go ahead, Larry. And you're a very great interviewer, too, I want to say. So,
oh, well, thank you. I appreciate
it. Very calm, very logical, so have at it.
Oh, well, now things might change. No, this has been a pleasure. I have been so excited about doing this all week, and we're on the same wavelength, I want to tell you right now. I'm totally behind everything that you stand for and you do, and this is quite an honor tonight. Now, you were a park ranger for 30 years in Yellowstone. And I have to tell you, Bob, I received a few emails from some folks that I know about you that I think some of our listeners have been waiting to hear what you have to say about this, about your experiences in Yellowstone National Park with the, and I put quote, end quote, legendary Sasquatch.
Yep.
Now, I have to tell you, I think I told you this on the phone when I first called you, that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had me come to Shepherdstown, West Virginia, at the National Conservation Training Center, and I did a lecture on Sasquatch for them, because I'm a wildlife educator. Many, many years ago, when I started doing some research into this subject, I started talking to some pretty reliable folks. And what I thought might be a legend, I have decided over the last 30 years that there's a lot of truth to this. Could you tell this audience that we have here tonight your first experience in Yellowstone with the Sasquatch?
There's different levels of experiences with this animal.
We want to hear every one.
Yes.
In great detail.
Yeah. When I worked Bureau of Sport Fisheries, I didn't hear anything from any of those people. But then you're there longer, and you're in start doing the backcountry stuff. And then you're talking to trail crew, and when you're in the cabins at night. And the first I heard about anything with a Bigfoot was there used to be blister rust control in Yellowstone. They'd have crews that would go out, and they would try to, you know, eliminate the ribes, you know, the currant bushes that were supposedly causing the problems with the white bark pine. And trail crew told me that one of the heads of the blister rust, this is before I got there, the crew was going along off trail down in, you know, some of the stuff southeast of Yellowstone Lake where I was patrolling, and going through into some heavier woods, and they came upon this elk carcass, fresh kill, and it was just like it was deboned. And they said it could smell around there, you know, kind of a rank smell, and then they saw these big footprints, you know, right next to it. It was the summertime stuff is where it was, and, you know, they'd travel all over off and on the trails, mostly off the trail. So the guys there kind of spooked out. They had some cherry bombs along, and so, and they shouldn't have been, you know, it was just a weird situation. They actually, and you can feel things once in a while back there, not just so much Bigfoot, but, you know, kind of like the Indians say, you feel it in the breeze. You can feel it on the sides of your face, you know, the way the air comes in on you. And it's on your cheeks, and that's when you get something that's stirring. And it's not something that you can even call or think about that's tangible, but it's actually there. It really is there. And I think that's what they got. They were so close to it, and I'd say that that animal was really close because it was so moist and everything. So that's the first I heard about it through trail crew. And, you know, they were pretty legit guys. They'd been there quite a while, two of those guys, a number of years. And, you know, I'd learned a lot from them those first years about horses and packing. So, you know, I said, yeah, that's probably right. You know, but as far as my own experience, you know, you hear it, but then you don't really want to relate it to anything. You're thinking, you hear stories, yeah, okay, great. But you don't think you're ever actually going to have something of your own, you know, because it's so rare. So when I was patrolling in the northwest section of the park in what they call the Gallatin, and there's a trail up there going to Fawn Pass from US 191, and there's a smaller drainage, Fan Creek, where the outfitters would go up with fishermen off of the trail. And of course, outfitters and guides like to leave their fishermen and then do a little more scouting further up, maybe for just their own adventure, but maybe for to take you know, dudes the next time, but sidetrack and see where the outfitters are going, because if they're doing something illegal, then, you know, that's how I'd see their horse tracks. And so I came upon this outfitter and his main guide, and they were probably about 2 miles from the fishermen. They'd left lower, and we were just there talking, and it was in some meadows, and then up above us, going for probably a mile or so up before you get to the, you know, the passes up there in the Gallatin. A lot of trees, and all at once we heard this sound, and it was just like you could hear it through the whole valley. And I'd say it was probably a mile away, but it just kept going and going and going. And it's like, what the heck is this? And this is an outfitter from Nine Quarter Circle, had been there a long time. He'd never heard anything. The guide never had. And, of course, I didn't think to time it, but it sounded like sort of like a thousand elk going to their death, or kind of a combination Tarzan, and they never did let up, you know, and they never took a breath, this thing didn't. So I thought, what kind of wildlife can make that kind of noise, you know, without even having to take another breath, you know, to start again? So, you know, it's like, wow, what the heck is this? But it definitely affected me. And then a few weeks later, I was coming out of Sportsman Lake Cabin up onto the high stuff, and it was not above timberline, but is high alpine meadows where you got subalpine fir thickets. And cross country, it would have been probably maybe a mile from where we'd heard this thing earlier. And then, you know, I guess all at once, and I think I had either one or two pack horses behind me and my riding horse, and you could always tell when a bear is there, and that saves you a lot of times having to be on a horse, because all at once they'll smell it, and when they smell a grizzly bear, their noses, they just start flaring and snorting. Their nostrils flare way out. And, of course, then they look to where the bear is, and I look down from this slope. It's fairly steep. Dirt with some trees on it. And down below were these, it's probably about a 60 or 80 acre meadow with these spruce thickets, you know, where they kind of go up teepee shape. You know, they're maybe, I don't know, 40 feet wide. In fact, in the wintertime when you're skiing, you go to those things because even though you may have 5-6 feet of snow outside of those things, it'll be bare ground inside. That's how much and how dense these subalpine fir thickets are. So I looked down. It probably wasn't any more than, I don't know, 40, 50 yards away, I'd say, something like that. And there was a little deer down there, you know, right below me. And I was like, I thought, what the heck? And I was right in the edge of one of these fir thickets, and probably no more than 5 feet from the edge of it. And I was just kind of standing there and grazing a little bit. And I thought, you know, what the heck if... why is this deer here if there's a grizzly bear here? You know, so I tried to hold the horses, and whenever they're flaring noses like that, you know, and their eyes get bug-eyed, they're wanting to get out of there. But, you know, curiosity is like, I held, you know, the reins real tight, and but, you know, you can't have them going down the slope because then they can get wrapped up in their lead ropes, and then you got a real wreck and a real mess, and you're going to have animals hurt or yourself. But I probably held it there probably 20, 30 seconds. And I was just saying, hey, I can't hold the horses anymore, not the way they're jacking around. And then all at once this deer just took off, not from me, but he bolted straight away from that thicket. And then out of the other side of that thicket comes this thing that's running on two legs, and it's longer black hair. And you want to believe it's a bear, because it's got that long black hair on it, but it's running on two legs, and it's got long arms, and it's swaying back and forth with those arms. It never did look at me. It just stayed parallel to me until it hit the next thicket of trees, and basically it did like a human. It would pick up cover. If you got a bear or any animal that I know of, they're running straight away from you. They're trying to get the furthest distance. But this thing was trying to go, and so he zigzagged across this meadow, picking up cover and staying behind it. Then he zigzagged to the next one until he finally got into the deep woods. So, you know, I don't think he was 7 or 8 feet high. You know, he was definitely taller than I am, and I'm 6 feet. He was probably between my height and 7 feet tall, I'd say. And it wasn't running real fast, you know, like a, some, you know, 100-yard dasher type thing. It was covering ground pretty well, and the strides were long. I mean, I played a lot of sports in college and could have signed with the Minnesota Twins as a pitcher. So I guess athletic stuff I think about more than somebody else. And this thing... it knew where it was doing, what it was doing, to get, and I have no doubts looking back on it, that thing was stalking that deer. And of course it was the, well, Bigfoot, if you want to call it. It's the one that, you know, it couldn't stay there anymore. You know, with me right there, I'm sure it saw me right away. Those horses were smelling it. I never did smell it. The horses did. And so that was my first time experience with Bigfoot, which then after that, then I'd start asking outfitters if they'd ever heard anything. You know, I'd ask them what they'd ever heard that was strange or weird. And because I didn't want to give away what I'd heard to let them, you know, try to copycat it. And then you try and find out from other rangers and things like that. And, you know, those that are seeing footprints. I did see footprints of what I'm sure was Bigfoot when I was on winter ski patrol going into our Hartley cabin. Another fisheries guy was with me and another biologist and an historian. And we both, it's fairly deep snow, but his march was fairly packed. And these tracks crossed, you know, perpendicular to ours in the snow. And if you got an animal running, it can drag its foot, so to speak, where it looks bigger than it is. But these pretty well set straight up and down, you know, in that snow, and probably went in probably, I don't know, no more than 8 to 10 inches. And then it would pick its foot pretty much straight up and then drop it again. And, you know, the other guy and I, we stretched our skis out to see how long it was. And about as length as what we could stretch those skis, you know, from back to front, that was, you know, the stride that that animal had. So I guess those are the first tracks, and then probably it was in 76 or so when I heard it, and maybe, you know, it was the same year, maybe it was 76, 78, somewhere in there. I recorded it, you know, in my, you know, log books that I had. But then I went to Thoroughfare in the southeast corner, and, you know, I'd let other rangers know, and then this one ranger said he took a real reliable account from a tourist that was hiked into Beulah Lake and watched one for about 10 minutes on the other side of that very small lake. And this is a guy that said, you know, it sounded really legit, Bob. Anyway, as a start, there's more after that. I'm monologuing. Ask me some question, and then I'll tell you more, I guess, if we have time.
Well, I have a billion questions. Did you? So you talked about with other fellow employees?
Yeah. After that, then you start asking trail crew. You know, if they've heard anything. Trail crew had heard up in what we call Mountain Creek. It's right near that area where those the guys in the 60s, you know, saw that deboned elk, freshly deboned, and, you know, then with the track. And they'd herd it up Mountain Creek, which is going towards our Eagle Pass. And then I talked to a couple long-term backpackers that actually said, you know, they'd seen the track up in Fishhawk Pass, which is a real remote pass in the Absarokas. And, you know, by then you'd heard that the Indians had said the Absarokas was the home of the Bigfoot. That's what the Indians, I guess, had always said. And, I don't know, a couple other outfitters I talked to had heard the same long sound. You know, I'd let them describe it. And, you know, for me, I didn't really care what anybody thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had enough confidence in myself that I didn't care if somebody thought I was wacko or not. You know, so you try to get that information. And then in the early 80s, when I was going up Mountain Creek itself, and I was going to our Howell Creek cabin, which is about 4 miles from the pass, I was coming in right at dark. With the, you know, riding in, and I wasn't, you know, maybe 200 yards from the cabin, and then no more than a couple hundred yards behind the cabin, you know, here it is, same sound, except this time it's a lot closer, and so this time I timed it, and I said, man, I got to hear how long this thing is, and it went on for about 23 or 26 seconds, I can't remember now, but again, with uninterrupted volume and sound, I'm sure you could have heard that two miles away very easily. I looked in the morning for tracks, but and it wasn't any snow on the ground then, and it's a real rocky area, and I never could find a track on that one. But I don't know, I would have been had to be very lucky to find a track on that one too. And then we had the 88 fires, and there were no more reports for probably about 5 years after that. And then trail crew was up Mountain Creek again, probably about 2 miles below the cabin, and they'd already known what I'd heard, and they said all at once, man, they heard it, you know, right up off to the side. And, you know, they didn't time it, but everything they described again was exactly what I heard. So there's definitely a lot of people, enough there in Yellowstone. I think those animals pretty much stayed in heavy timber. A lot of spruce thickets is where we had another guy that was a bus driver for Yellowstone Park Company, and he'd do, you know, 12, 18-mile day hike trips where he'd cross from, like, one side and get picked up on the other, and then on his days off, and then he'd just stay illegally along. He'd get off the trail. You're supposed to stay at campsites, but he said he was in some pretty thick timber, and that was over there near the Lamar, going up from, as you're going from Fishing Bridge, you talk about, you go up Pelican Valley, and then into over the top, and Miss Pass, and then you're in Upper Lamar, and that's about where he was. And he said he was sleeping there because he didn't want anybody to see him, you know, where he was illegally camping. And all at once, he said it wasn't any more than 15 feet from him. And this thing in the middle of the night just started letting this big sounds out. He says just scared the hell out of him. And he said I don't remember if he said he could smell it or not, but he said he got up after that and he hiked all the way out. So, you know, he hiked, which is fairly dangerous hiking at night.
Oh, man.
The bears, you know, meeting the bear on the trail. But, yeah, so definitely reports they're starting, I think, you know, now you're getting more vegetation again, and I think, you know, you're going to get more areas where they, you know, with all those fires, it took a lot of that dense timber out, and, you know, there may have been something in there after those fires, but anyway, we didn't have any reports there for a few years after those fires.
I had heard that after the fires that it was, they'd watched as the wildlife returned to those burned-out areas, and the bears were the ones that actually walked through the burned-out timber as if nothing had happened.
Your elk and your buffalo, they try to go the same places where they did before, you know, where the trails were. And they could do it, you know, I don't know if this is exactly what your pattern or your thought is on it, until you start having the trees falling down, you know, 4 years or so after that. And then you finally get where there's too much timber down and they can't go through anymore. You know, there's just too much, kind of like matchsticks all piled on top of each other in that thick woods. But bears could walk on top of those trees, you know, the ones laying down, and zigzag through those things to still interconnect the meadows, you know, where the trails where they used to go to. Yeah. So they can move better than, you know, your four-legged herbivores.
So as a last thought, what do you think the future is for our national parks and places like Yellowstone?
I hate to say it, but you get too many people in the government that are too political, and you get a place like Yellowstone, everybody's trying to, you know, extend their, you know, make their career better, go higher up. So they try to get favor with those above them. So then there aren't too many that can, you know, don't in some way want to exploit it. And it's like up on our upper Pelican Creek, up on what they call the Muir Plateau. Mm-hmm. Up on the Muir Plateau, we got mountain bison up there. I have no doubt whatsoever they're the ones that were there well before any of the ones were introduced. And they can't stand people, and they're allowing outfitters to go up in there. So they don't have many years left. So I'm a little pessimistic about the backcountry of places like Yellowstone and what's going to happen to them.
Bob, I want to tell you, this has been an absolutely fascinating hour. And I want to thank you so much for coming on tonight, because I know my audience is spellbound with every word that you said tonight. It was absolutely fantastic. I want to have you back sometime. We'd love to.
Sounds great.
We'd love to hear more about your exploits. People can go to your website. Just Google Bob Jackson is a tall grass bison ranch. You ship buffalo meat around the world, correct?
Yes, we do, all over. In fact, we're going to New York City for the holidays. We're we're dropping off meat in Chicago, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and then New York. So,
well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I love to tell. It's good to tell the remembering, and if you want to call it war stories, yes.
It's great. We want to thank Bob Jackson. I want to thank Eric Coltman for running the board over there in Pennsylvania. Folks, this is Larry Batson. We'll be here Christmas Eve, so tune in. We'll have an exciting guest. This is Larry Batson, and thank you for joining us today on My Wild World. Good night, everybody.
I want to tell Larry, we don't have a website, but they can Google us and find out. Okay.
That's right. All righty. Thank you, Bob.
Yeah. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.